Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And that's right, I am here, I promise. Hang on. So many things to do, so many buttons to push, so many people to make sure are happy and set up. Before we do the show, sorry about last week, but like many people, I was snowed in. I wasn't going anywhere, and the guy who didn't show up to plow our 200-yard driveway made sure of that. So thank you, Mr. Guy, who I don't know, who didn't plow. But he did show up Monday after I missed work, too. So thank you for finally showing up, Mr. Unknown Plow Guy, so that we can be here this week, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Conversation today, pushed back a week from last week, finally, Southern Environmental Law Center here in Charlottesville. Our guests, Senior Attorney Greg Bupert. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Glad to be here.
And thank you so much. And Attorney Will Cleveland.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Well, it's really nice. After last week, you know, what's the cell phone number so I can call you early, late Saturday night or early Sunday morning, and we can know if we're going to do this. And then this week, it's on Friday afternoon, at the end of the work week. Can you come in this week instead? So the flexibility of attorneys at the Southern Environmental Law Center, Charlottesville. At least these two guys, thank you for your flexibility.
We had to expend a little marital capital.
It's a true fact, we did. So to our wives who are out there listening right now, we miss you and we'll see you soon.
I hope I didn't get put down for any any, you know, dues to Ms. Bupert and Cleveland, assuming that they might go by that last name. So we are going to talk about environmental issues today, Southern Environmental Law Center. By the way, before we get too deep into the topics, we are going to talk about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which many people know as the one going through Nelson County. We're going to talk about the coal ash, what happened at the BRIMO power plant, which came out of the newspaper a couple weeks ago, the Clean Power Plan. Some new federal energy requirements, what's going on in the General Assembly. We're going to be getting into all that. But why is the Southern Environmental Law Center part of this? What do you do? I was assuming, wait, I had two guys from the SELC here who could actually talk about this.
You do. SELC is a region-wide organization. We've got offices in six southeastern states. We have about 60 lawyers, and we are a public interest advocacy organization, and we take on environmental issues, the most important environmental issues in our state. So Will and I focus, we're located here in Charlottesville, and our work is based in Virginia, but we're doing the same work in Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina.
And an assumption, which I'm good at and often wrong at, is that attorneys doing this work are not making as much money as you could doing some, you know, private practice work. So is that right? And if so, why are you into this? And did you have to do spouse capital for that to take these jobs as well?
The answer to the first question is yes. The financial reward is not quite as voluminous as a private law firm's, where actually Greg and I both started. But the sort of moral and lifestyle awards are far more greater. We both chose this because this is what we wanted to do. My wife and I moved back to Charlottesville, which is where we met actually about 18 months ago. And when we were moving back to Charlottesville, the only thing I wanted to do was to find a job at the Southern Environmental Law Center. I've been doing environmental law ever since I got out of law school, and the best place to do it was at the Southern Environmental Law Center. And I was lucky enough that they happened to be hiring. I interviewed with Greg, actually, and apparently he put in a good word for me. So thanks, Greg, for letting me be here.
Glad to have you. Glad to have you.
All right. So again, Greg Bupert and Will Cleveland here talking for events that are going on with the Southern Environmental Law Center, cases that are taking place there. So what do you want to do first? You want to do the pipeline first?
Yeah, why don't Rick, why don't we talk about the pipeline? There's been some big news.
Yeah, so I guess its official name is the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
That's right.
For many people here locally, then it's always been in the news for coming through Virginia, Dominion Power bringing this pipeline through Virginia, through the national forest, and then through the private property of hundreds of landowners in Nelson County. I mean, that's where you see the signs for most of us. If you're taking 29 South, you see the no pipeline signs in people's yards. So why is the SELC involved? Because you don't get into the private ownership part of this.
Well, the private landowner, this issue, if you've been in Charlottesville the last year and a half, this issue has been in the news weekly, almost daily, and the reason is it's affecting many people along its route. The pipeline is 550 miles, so it touches a lot of private property. SELC got involved initially when the project was proposed in the summer of 2014 because it crossed through both the Monongahela and the George Washington National Forest in an area of those national forests that's really represents the best remaining natural wild forest in our region, and in fact, on all of the East Coast. SELC had spent several years working very diligently to keep natural gas drilling out of the George Washington National Forest. We were successful doing that. The Forest Service made a decision to place most of the forest off limits to drilling in 2014, and working on this project was a natural outgrowth of that work. So our focus began with the National Forest, but we've expanded the work we're doing because this pipeline touches the National Forest, but also touches many other important cultural, historic, and natural resources in our region.
Greg, when you talk about natural gas drilling, is that fracking?
The forest had been proposed to be open for fracking in a draft. The National Forest was evaluating whether or not to open the forest for drilling. We understood that the decision was leaning towards actually making those public lands available for drilling, and we were working diligently to protect those lands from this industrial process. Fracking really is an intensive industrial land use, among other problems. And if you've been out to the GW, you know that it's a wild and unspoiled place. It's a place where many people go to recreate, and it's a natural ecosystem that provides water for many communities in the Shenandoah Valley, and we are trying to protect those uses of the National Forest.
Not to get too far off topic, but we said a moment ago that the SELC does not get involved in the private ownership, the private land issues. If this Atlantic Coast Pipeline were to be coming, where does it start? Ohio?
It starts in West Virginia, northwestern West Virginia.
If it were to start there and just through luck, change of environment, were to not have to go through the forest, through the national forests, but were to be, how many miles is it? 1,300 miles? I'm just throwing out numbers now. I don't know.
The total length of this project is somewhere in the neighborhood of 550 miles.
So if it were not to go through a national forest, but were to still have influence on thousands of individual homeowners, would the SELC just have to say, you know what, we can't talk about that, or we can't speak to that because it's not our gig?
No, we would stay, and we plan to stay, if that does happen, plan to stay involved in this project. The reason is it's regardless of whether it's on the national forest or not, it's passing through some of the most rugged terrain in the East, and it's really almost impossible to build a project at this scale across that landscape without significant impacts on natural resources.
All right. So again, our conversation today is with two attorneys from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Will Cleveland is here. Currently, we're talking about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline with Greg Buport. So, Greg, I want to know what your role is in this, and then tell us about the news that came out just the Friday before last, like 10 days ago.
SCLC, so I'll tackle your first question first. We represent, in the formal proceeding before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that's the agency that will approve the pipeline, we represent local conservation groups, four of them, and as well as the Natural Resources Defense Council. And so we've been monitoring that docket. We've been commenting on the things that are filed in that docket. And that's our official role as lawyers for these groups. However, a big component of the project, typically, Rick, when a pipeline like this is proposed, the primary approval that it needs comes from FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's the permit that the pipeline developer needs to go out and build its project. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a little bit different because it crosses a big chunk of federal land, specifically national forests, the GW and the Monongahela. And the Forest Service has an independent right of approval for the route on the national forest lands. And what we've seen, from the outset, we've said in our communication on this project that this area where the pipeline is proposed, some of the best remaining wildlands in our region, is not the appropriate place to build this kind of project. What we've seen over the last 6 months as the Forest Service really engaged in the review of the environmental impacts of this project is the agency took its obligations very seriously to understand and evaluate the impacts. And so 2 weeks ago, the Forest Service wrote a letter which was filed with FERC, its sister agency, that said, this project, we can't approve the route for this project as proposed over Cheat Mountain, Back Allegheny Mountain, and Shenandoah Mountain. And the reason is the project is inconsistent with our obligations under our own management plans and the standards and guidelines and laws and regulations that guide how we're supposed to manage these resources. The Forest Service didn't close the door on alternative routes, but they have said that these areas, these three mountains, are not the place to put this project.
How do you possibly keep track, and how do you keep non-attorneys interested in the topic when you mentioned at least four different organizations, the IDM group, and I'm just making up letters now, but the so-and-so organization, this group, et cetera. And at some point, I guess the question here is, if you want to talk to the people, to the public, is that something that, you know, if even though you're representing, in your case, and the goal is to save the national forest, if you were to go out and have a conversation in front of the high school auditorium of people to present your case, there's an awful lot of federal groups out there that have to be appealed to or have the information. You have to wait for somebody to give their approval. This docket goes to this organization. This group is also part of it. Why is this so difficult in terms of people who have to say yay or nay? And how do you get the general public on your side without saying, being so simple as to say it, we have to tear down trees?
Well, Rick, those are good questions. This is an incredibly complex issue, and I think the public, from the beginning, the public's been really struggling to understand how this project gets approved, what the proposal is. And remarkably, we still don't know with this latest Forest Service decision, a year and a half into this project, we don't know, we don't have a clear sense of what the route that will ultimately be put forward is. So it's really a challenge for people to get a handle on. However, we're having people understanding and agreeing with our point of view on this issue hasn't been difficult at all. If you're touched, if this project touches your property or affects your business, I think the general sense in the community is really one of outrage. How does a private company get the right to enter my property and build this pipeline across my property? And that issue, that's really the core issue that's motivating huge public involvement in this issue. So at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I get an email anytime somebody communicates to that agency about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And it's really just remarkable the number of people speaking up with their concerns about the project.
That has been something, it sounds similar, although in your case, we're talking about the George Washington National Forest. Is this becoming more of a national concern? Because it's a similar problem as to what's going on for the pipeline coming from the tar sands in Canada. And is it in Nebraska or Canada where people are saying, no, you can't cut through here? And so is this how the general public is becoming involved? Is it's no longer just you or just the National Forest? Do you have to appeal to the individual landowner to get them involved?
For our work, we...
On your side. You need more numbers, and so pointing out how it hurts everyone in Nelson County, not just the 100 landowners.
You know, that hasn't been an issue really at all. I think if a place like Nelson County is a great example. The people who live on the route or people who just live in the county are following this project closely, and they're really concerned about its impacts. I would say that in the counties where the project is proposed, there's overwhelming concern and opposition among local residents.
Not quite 11:20 here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Greg Buport from the Southern Environmental Law Center as we talk about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. So, Greg, the National U.S. Forest Service sent their letter saying, we don't approve. Dominion stubbornly persisted on a route that was identified as severely destructive from the start.
I think that's right. And really, what this Forest Service decision really tells us is that we need a better system for locating and deciding whether or not to build these projects. We've been back in 20, right around this time last year, early in 2015, the Department of Energy released a study in which they concluded that upgrades to existing pipelines, flow reversals, so changing the direction natural gas moves in a pipeline, and increasing and taking advantage of unused capacity on pipelines, those three things would enable much of the demand for natural gas to be satisfied with existing infrastructure. We've been, in addition to other work we're doing on this pipeline, we've been digging into that that idea that we got from the Department of Energy. And what we're finding out is that there's, looking at all the existing pipeline infrastructure and other natural gas infrastructure in Virginia, we believe there's sufficient capacity to meet demand for natural gas out to about 2030. That's as far as we've looked with our models, and without new pipelines. And so we've been arguing both at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and also in our statements to the public that there's really a two-step inquiry that needs to happen before one of these projects is built. First, there needs to be a detailed evaluation of whether or not a new pipeline is actually needed to meet natural gas demand. I think there's good evidence that one might not be needed, that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is not needed. And let me give you an example that I think is really, really important. Dominion has proposed a new natural gas plant in Greensville County. That natural gas plant already, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline would connect to that natural gas plant, but that plant, if it's built, is already would already have service from an existing pipeline, with a 4 mile lateral built from that existing pipeline. The same is true for the Brunswick County Gas Plant, another project that is nearly complete. Which would also be connected to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. It already has gas service from an existing pipeline. So I think there's significant questions about whether or not we need a new pipeline to meet natural gas demand. So we've been arguing that FERC needs to undertake that evaluation. And if ultimately, after a careful and independent review, there's a need for a new pipeline, then we need a better process to locate these projects. Right now, we're stuck. I think what the Forest Service decision shows us is we're stuck with a ad hoc route planning by these companies. And Dominion has said in its filings, we've gone to extraordinary measures to identify the best route for our project. And what we know now from the Forest Service is that's simply not true. They didn't avoid the most sensitive areas of the national forest when they laid out their route. They simply thought we can force our project through these sensitive areas, and we can publicly say we've gone to extraordinary measures to find the best route. And I think we know now that's not true.
Just a few minutes left on this specific topic with Greg Bupert from the Southern Environmental Law Center. Questions that I should have asked 15 minutes ago and didn't. So let's rush through them as best we can. One of the reasons that it's been that the U.S. Forest Service has said we don't want to approve this has to do with they're protecting salamanders and squirrels and red spruce trees.
I think that's right. I mean, if you read the Forest Service letter, they identify specific requirements to protect certain species and the red spruce ecosystem. But that's not the whole story here. What we know is that this area contains some of the largest intact natural forests in the East, and it really is a unique resource that deserves protection. And those species provide legal hooks for the Forest Service as they manage their lands, and the agency takes those obligations very seriously, as we've been able to see in their filings regarding the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. But the big picture here is this region is the dark spot on the map. If you look at a nighttime photograph of the East Coast, this region in the George Washington, the Monongahela, is dark, and it's relatively undeveloped. It's a conservation opportunity that's really hard to find these days. And I think the Forest Service understands that.
Does a different governor, because our current governor is supporting Dominion on this, at least in several ways, does a different president lead to different U.S. Forest Service leadership? Does anything like that change the decision? Does a different president who's less interested in environmental and more interested in fracking and fuel change the leadership at the Forest Service?
You know, I think Senator Kaine made a very good point last summer when he wrote a letter about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. He said this: where this project goes should be based on scientific and technical information that's free from political influence. That's the way this project should work. The public deserves a process that is independent of political influence, and it's my hope that will be the case here. Of course, we'll have to see how that plays out.
All right. Greg Buport here from the Southern Environmental Law Center talking about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Take a break. We're going to come back with Will Cleveland and another important environmental topic.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel with 6 area locations.
And here we are today. Thank you for listening to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're going to jump into another topic. We could have kept going on the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. We could devote the entire hour to the upcoming topic, federal energy requirements for those folks who are. I mean, that's what we're here. This is the progressive voice of Charlottesville because we care about progressive topics such as the environment. Sometimes salamanders and trees come ahead of fuel, old fuel. Hey, where's the solar panels? So let's talk about some of these things, the federal energy requirements with Will Cleveland. So, Will, I'm doing my homework, and I'm like, clean power plan, and it repeats itself several times, but it takes a long time before I get to the what is it? So let's start with that.
That's absolutely right. The documents that EPA has put out are incredibly long and incredibly dense, and somewhat difficult to access, but that's because there's been so much time and so much effort and so much information packed into them. But in a nutshell, the Clean Power Plan is the first ever United States federal regulation addressing greenhouse gas pollution from existing stationary sources, which means power plants. It is the first time in United States history that we have attempted to cut our carbon and CO2 emissions from those sources. And that's what this plan plans to do.
Now, we're going to talk about it for the next 15 minutes or so, but it sounds like something that will be immediately scrapped in 2017 if we have a president from a specific party.
Well, that's not actually true. The way that it's a rule from EPA, it's not directly from the president, and EPA has put out a final rule, and under the way that the laws are structured for rulemaking from a federal agency, even if a new president were to want to change the plan, he'd have to go through the same type of process. He couldn't just immediately scrap it on day one. So we have a final clean power plan that EPA has put out, and all the states are obligated to comply.
Well, they're obligated to comply.
Yes, they are.
So is Virginia currently complying?
Well, the rule has not yet required obligation. The rule sets a target of 2030 for when the states must comply, although there are some interim periods before that each state must also hit slightly less stringent targets. But EPA has put out the final rule, and Virginia has stated unequivocally that it is going to comply. And what the rule does is it provides a fair amount of flexibility for the states. There are numerous ways in which the states can demonstrate their compliance. EPA has intentionally given the states that leeway so that they can pick what suits that state best depending on that state's particular energy mix, the amount of coal fire generation, the amount of natural gas generation, the amount of solar and wind resources. But if a state decides that they don't want to go through the process of writing their own compliance plan, then EPA will do it for them. But Virginia is not going to do that. Virginia has stated unequivocally they're going to write their own plan. That stakeholder process is ongoing right now, trying to figure out what is best for Virginia. How can Virginia move forward to a clean energy economy, grow renewable resources as quickly and as rapidly as possible, expand the economy, and lower greenhouse gas emissions at the same time?
So one of the notes that I took from reading this is that the urge stronger incentives for clean energy and energy efficiency. Those are viewed as separate categories, correct?
They are separate categories.
So which is easier?
Well, they're both pretty easy for Virginia.
You always
right now.
Do the easy thing first.
Well, they're both pretty easy. Virginia, sadly, is lagging in the amount of renewable and energy efficiency resources that it has developed over the last 10 to 15 years. There are other states that have far more robust programs for both of those types of resources. And so there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in both of those realms for Virginia to achieve. But when we say renewable resources, what we mean are zero-emitting resources that don't emit any carbon pollution. So solar, wind, offshore wind, onshore wind. Utility scale solar, which is sort of the big utility or the big solar arrays, and then also residential solar, rooftop solar arrays. There are all sorts of different renewable resources that we can deploy as a mix that are going to collectively reduce the amount of fossil fuel generation. We don't need as many coal plants. We don't need as many natural gas plants because we're generating electricity for free, effectively, because there's no fuel cost.
I heard... Let's phrase that properly. I heard from somebody else, it might have been an NPR person, it could have been the guy next to me when I was having a beer, that getting free energy doesn't allow for to keep the grid in good shape. You know, all those people who are making their own energy and selling it back to Dominion, well, that's no money for Dominion to then go rebuild our power grid. And so it's falling apart, and eventually we will all die.
No, we're not going to all die because people have solar arrays on the roofs of their houses.
That might have been in a Dominion press release that I read.
No, what renewable resources do and things that are like rooftop solar, they allow people to generate electricity at their own homes for their own consumption, and the industry argument goes that because they're generating their own electricity, they're not paying their share of keeping up the grid. What that argument ignores is the fact that the people aren't using that portion of the grid, and so the maintenance costs on the grid go down, and so that the utilities are able to keep the grid perfectly functional all the same.
But it's fewer people contributing to the upkeep. Are you saying that if there's 100 people using the grid and one person goes solar, so now there's only 99 people using the grid, that the grid is only being worn down at 99% of the rate that it was?
Well, for one thing, we're talking economies of scale. So the 99 versus 100 isn't really accurate because there are millions of people in Virginia who are using the grid. And second, a renewable resource like solar only generates electricity when the sun is shining. And so the people who have homes that use solar at nighttime when they're using electricity are not using their solar array. They're using electricity that they are purchasing off the grid. And so in that times, they are in fact contributing to grid maintenance because they're helping to pay for the electricity use.
So tell me more about, you said that this doesn't have to be fully implemented until 2030.
Yes, EPA has set 2030 as the date when every state must comply with the targets set for each state.
And this is a definite requirement.
Yes.
At what pace do you expect Virginia to keep up with this?
Well, so Virginia is actually, in terms of the southeastern states where the Southern Environmental Water Center operates, Virginia is unique in that it's the only state so far where the governor has come out vocally and strongly in favor of the Clean Power Plan. Governor McAuliffe, rightly so, recognizes that the Clean Power Plan is a great opportunity to leverage the state's potential for expanded renewable energy and energy efficiency resources. And that is an economic driver that cannot be outsourced. When you are installing a solar array on the roof of your house, those are jobs in Virginia that can't get outsourced. When you're having somebody come in and seal the ductwork in your house to improve your home's thermal efficiency, that's a job that can't get outsourced. These are all jobs in Virginia that help create and drive the economy. So Virginia, unlike the other southeastern states where we work, is moving forward quickly to develop its compliance plan. The Department of Environmental Quality, who are tasked with putting the compliance plan together, have already convened a stakeholder group to hash out the best ways to do it. That stakeholder group consists of members from Dominion, Appalachian Power,
the Natural Resources Defense Council, and many other merchant generating units who all sort of put together, form the big picture of what the Clean Power Plan needs to do and how best to achieve it.
But how does a company like Dominion, they can't possibly like the setup as it is now with what the EPA is demanding, because it sounds to me as though that's lost income for them. There needs to be a method or rules or regulations to make Dominion happy as well, so that they're making money from some way. If they're not, it's not because it's selling electricity to me at my poorly insulated home, then they have to get it from somewhere else. So how do you get Dominion and Appalachian Power, et cetera, how do you get them involved without being grumpy about it?
Well, to be fair to Dominion and Appalachian Power, my experiences with them, they are not grumpy about this. I was on a panel with a vice president from Dominion talking about the Clean Power Plan very recently. And everybody on that panel, it was the Department of Environmental Quality, the State Corporation Commission, Dominion, and I, all universally agreed that the Clean Power Plan is a pretty achievable thing for Virginia to do. To truth be told, the targets that EPA set are actually not that stringent. The lift that Virginia has to do collectively to meet the targets is not very significant. It's a very significant step towards recognizing that carbon pollution is something we need to address, but it's not something that is going to be terribly hard for Virginia to achieve. And part of that is because of steps that Dominion and Appalachian Power and the other power generation state had already taken long before EPA put out the rule. Most of the coal plants of Virginia have already come offline through independent factors that have nothing to do with the CPP or the Clean Power Plan. And it's because of steps like that that Dominion doesn't really have that much left to do.
11:37 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We're talking with Attorney Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center's Charlottesville office about the new federal energy requirements. Well, it's one of my notes here says the proposed rules also contain unnecessary and burdensome obstacles to using solar power to meet Clean Power Plan goals.
Well, what we would like to see the rule do is incentivize, which is a wonderful legal term that I hated when I first went into law school, but unfortunately it's one that we have to live with as lawyers, but basically encourage and create the best environment for expanding renewable resources as easily and efficiently as possible. And there are tweaks that EPA could make to the rule that we think they should make that would allow and encourage states to bring even more renewable resources online even faster.
What about, you mentioned early on about wind energy, and Virginia has had the option to put turbines across the mountains in the western part of the state, to put turbines off the coast in the east. And am I right to say that they are regularly, if not shot down, at least postponed due to red tape and other organizations that need to approve these things, et cetera?
You are right that right now we don't really have any wind resources at all in the state. Dominion and we are all actively exploring offshore wind as a great energy generator potential. There's a 12 megawatt project that Dominion is actively pursuing right now that we think would be a great test project to sort of figure out what are the difficulties of actually building those types of projects and what are the obstacles in bringing that electricity onto the grid. But you're right that there are always obstacles that come up. For instance, when you're talking about putting a wind turbine on top of a ridge, even if the people who support wind are in favor of that project, there might be people who don't want to see the ridge cluttered with a wind turbine. So you have a lot of interests to juggle there. But we're doing the best we can, and we're working with all our partner groups to find the best places to site a wind resource. That
if Dominion wanted to put wind turbines in the Monongahela and George Washington National Forest, do you think that that would receive better feedback? Would it still be possible that you're invading the space of the salamanders and the red spruce trees and the squirrels that are currently being put forth by the U.S. National Forest as reasons not to put the pipeline in?
I think those same arguments would still apply. I don't think the Dominion has the ability to go onto federal land and build a generating resource. I mean, this is actually more an area of Greg's expertise than mine in terms of what the national forests allow.
I'm just curious as to whether or not if we're changing energy resources from a fuel pipeline to solar or wind turbines, would we be a little more slack about allowing that in the national forest?
Rick, there are national forests that have wind turbines, for example. We need to be the issue with citing the wind resources. What are the environmental impacts? Not every place, not every location will be appropriate to build a wind farm. And there have been instances of wind farms built in California that have just a staggering number of golden eagle kills, for example. And that we can cite that resource in a way that's responsible. And there, so to answer your question specifically, ridges in the Appalachians present challenges for wind development. But this is a big state, and I feel confident there are places to build onshore wind that are both recognize the and mitigate the potential harm to sensitive environmental resources and generate clean power for Virginians.
Again, our guest, that's Greg Rupert, giving us a little pipeline information along with the clean power plan and sort of my question as to how those two might tie together. I want to move on to some of the other topics, but Will Cleveland from SELC here in Charlottesville, the clean power plan, it's talked about required to be met in 2030. Do you envision any serious changes in the plan between now and then to make it easier for states to meet, for businesses who may not support environmental issues as much as those of us hopefully listening on the 94.7 or at the SELC? Do you think it will be changed and lessened?
Well, it already has been in some ways. So what EPA did was they put out a proposed rule, and then they asked everybody who was possibly affected or interested in it to send them comments on the proposal. And they took those proposal or those comments, they evaluated them, and then they put out a final rule, which came out last summer in 2015. And that final rule, which is now final and will not change, incorporated a lot of those concerns and comments, and the ways in which EPA calculated the targets changed. It applied a more national uniform criteria, which I think was more fair to the various states. And as even Governor McAuliffe has said, the rule got a lot better for Virginia when it was finalized than as opposed to when it was proposed.
Do you think does it make it more difficult for certain states? I mean, the SELC, is it more difficult for southern states to meet this, or more difficult for a state like New York or more urban states? I guess New York isn't completely urban, but New Jersey or anything, or certain regions?
Well, I haven't done a 50-state survey, but my understanding is certainly the states where we work, everybody is moving towards compliance. We think that a lot of the states are going to have a pretty easy lift. And, you know, the states, you know, even a big coal state like Pennsylvania is moving forward pretty quickly with a compliance plan because they're not too worried about it.
11:44 here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Will and Greg from the SELC. Be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And we're back in action on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Beautiful Sunday. I'm hoping that more of my snow melts away. Greg, you wanted to toss something in there about tying those last two topics together, the pipeline and the clean power plan?
Rick, the clean power plan and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline are linked, closely related, really. And one thing we didn't mention in the first part of our show is that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is not the only pipeline proposed in Virginia. There's another project near Roanoke, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, that's proceeding on the same schedule. And I think at a time when the state is trying to determine how it will comply with the Clean Power Plan, what proportion of renewable resources it'll bring online, how much it'll rely on natural gas, really underscores the need to take a careful look at whether or not two major pipeline projects, and actually there are others in the wings, whether these projects are needed, whether is that how Virginia is going to proceed with complying with the Clean Power Plan? And right now we don't know. And the work Will is doing is advocating for more renewable resources, and that's another factor that bears on the need for these pipeline projects.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one thing I should say about the way that SCLC approaches a lot of these problems is that we want to have smart growth and smart development. And so the first question we always ask when there's a new big multi-billion-dollar project proposed is, do we need this thing? What is the need? And as Greg was talking about with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, it turns out we don't need a new pipeline at all. We have an existing pipeline infrastructure that can adequately meet the needs that we have now and the needs we're going to have going forward. And then the second question is, if there is a need for a new project of any kind, what is the most cost-efficient and least environmentally impactive project that we can pursue? So instead of it being a $1.5 billion natural gas-fired power plant, what if we built some solar instead, which has a far smaller environmental impact and can really help in terms of how we're going to comply with the Clean Power Plan?
I'm not always convinced that businesses see those as things to tie together. Cost-efficient doesn't always work with smart, right? Because it can be cost-efficient, but that doesn't come out to be most profitable going forward.
That's true, but the narrative that has existed for so long that renewable resources are simply too expensive is just not true anymore. Even Dominion's own integrated resource planning document that they put out, you know, 6-8 months ago shows that solar is actually the cheapest thing that we can do right now. It's just a question of how much solar can we put on the grid and how can we adequately integrate it properly. But renewable resources are very cost effective.
Well, is that how, to jump to another topic, uranium mining, is that one of the reasons that the court looked at this case? Give me some quick background. I'll get the listeners some quick background about the uranium mining down in the Danville area.
That's right. That's where it is. The uranium mining thing is actually kind of its own separate beast. Since 1983, Virginia has had a law on the books that prohibits uranium mining on traditional uranium mining on private lands. And in Virginia, arguably, there is the largest uranium deposit in the country. But that's only worth mining if the price of uranium is such that it makes it a profitable endeavor. And since 1984 or so, uranium has not been priced properly. And so nobody has been pursuing mining it. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, the interests that currently own that deposit decided that uranium was now worth mining. And so they tried to get the General Assembly to overturn the ban that had been around for 30 years. And they were unsuccessful in that attempt. Having failed at the General Assembly, and now with Governor McAuliffe, who has expressly said that he would veto any law that overturned the mining ban, they brought a lawsuit in federal court. And the main tenet of that federal court action was that the Federal Atomic Energy Act, which regulates an entirely separate area of radiological issues, preempts any state law concerning uranium mining. The state attorney general appeared in that case and defended the state statute. And we got involved representing local riverkeeper groups, the Dan River Basin Association and the Roanoke River Basin Association, who are local residents who very much don't want to see uranium mining happening in the Danville area. And so we got involved. We filed a brief with the court asking the court to throw out the case as being an unreasonable and kind of unjustifiable reading of the Atomic Energy Act. And the court agreed with us, and the court agreed with the attorney general and threw out the case. And then the owners of the uranium deposit have since filed an appeal with the federal Fourth Circuit, saying that they want the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to review the case as well. While that is going on, they've also filed a lawsuit in state court asking the state court to overturn the ban. But this has nothing to do with the Clean Power Plan, has nothing to do with what is the best energy mix for Virginia. It has everything to do with maximizing profits.
Got it. Again, our guest today, Will Cleveland, Greg Buport from Charlottesville's office of the Southern Environmental Law Center, talked about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the new federal energy requirements with the Clean Power Plan. I had that little tidbit in there about people making as much money as possible in uranium mining. Will, you mentioned the General Assembly in that little bit about uranium mining once or twice. There's got to be issues that the SCLC is interested in that are being discussed, brought up as bills at the current General Assembly.
There are. There are bills that we both support, and then there are bills that we don't think are very good for Virginia. One of the bills that we don't think is good for Virginia is a proposed legislation that would require any clean power plan, compliance plan that DEQ writes to go through General Assembly approval before it can go to EPA. As Greg said earlier, you know, clean power plant compliance and a lot of environmental issues, those are the areas of science. The best way to protect the environment and meet all of our needs should be left to the experts and not to the politicians. And the idea that the General Assembly members, intelligent though they are, think that they could be do a better job figuring out what is the best scientific reason for doing something than the scientists who came up with the reason, strains credibility.
Well, we have proof outside still that global warming does not exist. Just look in every parking lot and you'll see piles of it. And I believe that's what the gentleman at the I can't pronounce his last name.
Inhofe, wasn't it?
Inhofe, who brought the from snowball Kansas, who's there, brought his snowball in. Right. Proof that there is no global warming because it snowed.
We don't call it global warming. We call it climate change. And the idea is that as the climate changes, we have more and more severe weather events. Those can be significant cold storm snaps, or they can be significant heat spells. I mean, 2015 was, I think, the hottest year on record ever. And I think of the last 15 hottest years on record, 12 of them have been in the last 15 years.
And Rick, one thing that went on the climate change issue, one thing to remember is that weather and climate are different. Climate is the long-term patterns over time that we see playing out. Weather events can be all over the place, and so of course, one big snowfall like the one we had last week really has nothing to do with climate change.
Yes, maybe we should go to Washington, D.C. and share that information with a couple people. Well, there's also, is the regional greenhouse gas initiative still being talked about in Richmond?
It is. There is a bill before the General Assembly right now called the Virginia Coastal Protection Act, which would authorize Virginia to join an organization like REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a coalition of northeastern states that have already taken the initiative to limit their greenhouse gas emissions, and it has been a very, very effective means of doing that. Those states have reduced their greenhouse gas emissions dramatically since REGI started, and they've also managed to keep their economies thriving while doing that. It would be a great way of – it would be one path of many for Virginia to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, and it would also set aside a lot of money to help those areas of Virginia that are most vulnerable to climate change and sea level rise, particularly the Hampton Roads area, which according to some studies behind New Orleans is the second most at-risk region of the country to sea level rise.
Yes, my hometown area. So who's pushing for this? Who's pushing against it? Are there specific names in the assembly that people would best write to, call?
There are. I'd have to get back to you on who would be the best contact for that.
And what are the expectations of it actually passing?
Cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic. All right. Well, I think cautiously optimistic with anything related to environmental issues these days is often the best we can hope for. That's Will Cleveland from the Southern Environmental Law Center. 11:55 here on the Sunday morning wake-up call. I got one more topic I want to make sure we spend some time on. Put Greg Buport back in the microphone staging area. The BRIMO power plant. Now, BRIMO, not too far from the Charlottesville area, 40-minute drive maybe?
I think it's about 40, 45 minutes away.
Tell us the story, because I think even though, you know, I've lived in the Charlottesville area for 30 years now and I've heard of BRIMO, I was like, what? I didn't know that when the story came out of the newspaper.
BRIMO, the story that's been in the news recently, Rick, is about the discharge of wastewater contaminated with coal ash into the James River at the BRIMO power plant. But really, this is a story that is region-wide. For decades, utilities have stored their coal ash in unlined pits. And this is the residue that's left over after coal is burned. It's typically washed out of the power plant into an unlined pond, usually next to a river, because power plants are often on major waterways. And at BRIMO, there are several ponds like this. We've discovered at BRIMO and at other sites in Virginia, these ponds, not surprisingly, they're unlined. They've been leaking contaminants into the adjacent waterway for decades. And this typically includes things like arsenic, selenium, cadmium, things you don't want in your rivers, in the water where you're catching fish or water that's going to be used for drinking water. Dominion is proposing to cap ponds at BRIMO in place. What that means is they will dry out the coal ash and they will put an impermeable cap over the pond. But in order to do that, 100 to 200 million gallons of wastewater from that pond has to be discharged. It has to be removed from the pond. Dominion wants to put it in the James River. The issue that's gotten a lot of attention in the news is what will be the limits on the concentrations of pollutants in that water? And we right now, for example, the permit that was issued 2 weeks ago for Dominion to discharge this water from the BRIMO ponds has a maximum limit for arsenic of 530 parts per billion. Well, that's, you know, I don't expect the listeners to know what that means, but let me put it in perspective for you. We know that number can get a lot lower with proper treatment technology, and similar permits in North Carolina have maximum concentration limits of 14.5 parts per billion. So 14 parts per billion in North Carolina, 530 at BRIMO.
Well, let me ask you real quick. I'm reading about this, and the EPA doesn't even classify coal ash as toxic waste, correct?
That's right. That's a decision EPA made under one federal statute called RCRA. However, under the clean, that doesn't change how these constituents are classified under the Clean Water Act. And arsenic, cadmium, selenium, these are toxics, identified toxics under the Clean Water Act. The real issue, the real legal issue with these permits is whether or not the state was required to impose limits based on treatment technology. We think they were. We made that argument before the State Water Control Board. We said the technology is available. It's used elsewhere. It's routinely employed to bring down the limits, the concentrations of pollutants in this kind of wastewater, and it should be used here. The state disagreed, and our client at that site, the James River Association, is seriously evaluating its next steps to protect the James River.
And Pat Calvert from the James River Association will be our guest next week, so we'll talk a little bit more about the BRIMO power plant and the environmental issues about that next week. But, Greg, I want to know, with like the 60 seconds we have left for an attorney, why would this be approved to allow them to dump water into the James River?
Well, I can tell you what the state has said, and you're right, Rick. Getting a lawyer to answer a question under 60 seconds is a challenge.
My father's an attorney.
But the state has said we've imposed limits that protect water quality, and we've complied with the existing regulations. That's what DEQ said to the State Water Control Board, and the State Water Control Board accepted that. We think that's a misinterpretation and a misapplication of the Clean Water Act. We think the Clean Water Act requires technology-based limits. We know they've been successfully employed other places, and we know that this wastewater, before it goes into the James, can be a lot cleaner.
Now, the BREMO plant has made the news, but there are other plants elsewhere that are having similar issues or are expected to have similar issues.
There's the Possum Point plant, which is located on a tributary to the Potomac in Prince William County, and there are other facilities that will be going through this process during this year.
Folks can go to the SELC website to keep up to date on what's happening for any and all of these topics we've discussed today.
We have information on all these topics on our website.
SELC.org, correct?
Yeah, you can also go to southernenvironment.org.
All right, because there's way more conversation about these topics than we ever got to today. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the federal energy requirements with the Clean Power Plan, what's happening at the General Assembly, the BREMO power plant and the toxic coal ash, as well as the uranium mining ban, which does get to continue. Will Cleveland, Greg Buport, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Rick, great to be here. Thanks.
All right. Next week, we'll have Pat Calvert from the James River Association. We'll talk a bit more about what's happened in the James River with the toxic coal ash, but other topics as well. Everyone have a great week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.